And coming up next on the stream of free radio, on the net, actually, and also, of course, on the archives here for HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. It is the 19th of October, 2023, Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, which is yet another flashback, which is a little hard to kind of pinpoint in time. It's from May of 1998, and I've been kind of struggling with this one throughout the afternoon to get a clear sense of exactly which show it is, but the people who put this in the archives, and I was probably one of them, didn't do a very clear job. But in any case, this is it covers a variety of topics. It's a studio show, so you'll be invited to call in. Of course, there's no studio to call into. If you have any comments on what you've heard from this 30-year-old show, nearly 30 years old, call me on the HUF line. That's at Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, 831-423-4833. And eventually I'll probably get back to you with if I have ideas of what might be helpful for answering your question. So, this was around the time when we were struggling to unsuccessfully get enough signatures for the, I think it was the second battle to put the sleeping ban law, the municipal code 6.36, on the ballot so it could be repealed. We got a lot of signatures, but this was, I think, the year of El Nino, the severe weather storms and such. That's really not a good excuse for why we failed. We had a number of people going out trying it. We didn't have paid signature gatherers. And I guess there isn't a lot of talk about that. I think David Silva, an activist who was with us until about 5 years ago when he died overseas, he was one of the main organizers of this effort. You'll hear some familiar voices here if you're a longtime listener. Battling Bob LaMonica comes in, trying to understand what was going on with the change of management with the Homeless Community Resource Center, which became the Homeless Services Center, which is now Housing Matters. It's the complex out at 115 Coral Street. Considerably smaller operation, in a way, considerably more egalitarian because they actually fed anybody who came in. You didn't have to be in a program to do it. And that, of course, changed as they began to try to grab grants, and maybe they started feeling they had to respond to what government grant doler outers required. But that certainly has changed. You'll hear from Donna Dice and Marco Marocchi, who headed the... I have the impression it... I don't know how powerful it was, but it was on target. The Tenants Rights Union of Santa Cruz, or TRUSC, as it called itself. And they really went out of their way to help tenants who are at threat of eviction and trying to lobby for their rights and to help them in court when they were being faced with landlords that simply wanted to sweep them out and sweep in the next more profitable set of tenants, regardless of the situation. Looks like I am not entirely sure, but it looks like there's also an interview with a Salinas activist or maybe a Monterey County activist. In those days, there weren't many... There were some activists from the streets, but the funded activists were people who were supposedly trying to get people into shelters or into housing, and at least that's how they earned their keep and got their grants. They weren't really concerned with establishing the civil rights of the broader homeless population that stayed outdoors, regardless of all the flim-flam talk about housing and so forth. And some people got into housing, of course, probably in a way, I don't know if it was more proportionately than now, but certainly rents were cheaper, and for some, housing was more accessible. The issue for me, of course, primarily my concern with the Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides show was primarily fair treatment, whether it be with respect to housing, with respect to being in a public space, with respect to going to city council and so forth, and arguing for changes and things. I think you're also going to hear a segment from the Jolly Roger Comedy Troupe, which was the Free Radio Berkeley, or Liberation Radio Berkeley, I'm not sure what the exact name of it was, the kind of flagship pirate radio station. Although the guy who created the cheap transmitters, Stephen Dunifer, who actually may be interviewing shortly for an upcoming show, I got in touch with him recently. He's a lot older, but he still sounds feisty. He said that he didn't like calling his stations pirate stations because the real pirates were the corporate folks who had seized the airways and walled off the people, walled off the poor people, and were ripping them all off and then charging them to boot. There's stuff about Portland and Eugene and their new approaches compared to ours for establishing, at least decriminalizing to some extent, homeless folks, particularly in their vehicles. The struggle for the war to tolerate, if not legalize, medical pot. And then the issue around, as I was saying before, I didn't quite conclude it. The Homeless Community Resource Center was headed by an activist named Karen Gillette, who I talk about at length in this segment in response to a phone call from Battling Bob LaMonica, who calls in. Gillette is a figure with whom I've had many differences of opinion, and you'll hear me discuss those differences of principle and policy there. I don't think she ever... I don't think she ever volunteered to be interviewed, but we were concerned about how her homeless community resource center treated people, and also how she was treated when she was, I think she was, there was some concern at the time. Homeless Community Resource Center was merging with the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, which owned some of the property back there on which the new 115 Coral Street complex, or the old one that was a continuation, which continued the place, all the social services around the corner of Highway 1 and Highway 9 are on property, some of which was owned by the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. Anyway, they formed a coalition, a new group called the Homeless Services Center, or I called it the Homeless Lack of Services Center. But in any case, it's all about sort of the controversies as they tried to oust Karen Gillette, who I didn't think should be ousted for unfair reasons, but I had problems with how she managed it. Her previous, was primarily initially a free meal operation and also became a tolerated sleeping zone when the back 40 was open. That's the piece of property that you can still see people sleeping on it. You know, now people are returning to the area in front of Housing Matters and sleeping there. Saw some this morning as I drove down to the Huff meeting. Anyway, listen to it. Check it out. See if you find it of interest. And if you have questions, call me on the Huff line. HuffSantaCruz, .org is also where you'll find a lot of other shows around the same time. You can also follow some of the history if you get fascinated with it, as I sometimes am. Of course, I was there involved in it, and that may be one of the reasons why for me. But if you find this worth pursuing, there's a lot of historical material on the Huff website. So here it is, a flashback. It's either May 24th or thereabouts of 1998.
Hey there. Stay tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 for 2.5 hours of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. The reports on new assaults on cannabis patients, the upcoming city council meeting on Tuesday, and a whole essentially important announcement from the Trust in Tenants' Rights in Santa Cruz. Actually, a long interview on a number of subjects with them. Civil rights for the poor here in Santa Cruz with Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, I think it's called. I'm your host. I'm Robert Norris. I'll be with you for the next 2.5 hours.
John Randall, the king and I, and the catcher in the right. Eisenhower vaccine, England's got a new queen.
coffee of Rockefeller, Campanella, Communist Bloc. Roy Khan, one for all, Tuscanini, Daquan, Gin, Gin, Food Falls, Rock Around the Clock. Einstein, James Dean, Brooklyn, Down a Winning Team, Davy Crockett, Peter Pan, Elvis Presley, Disneyland, Fargo, Budapest, Alabama, Khrushchev, Richard's Place, Katie Race, Trouble in the Suez.
We didn't start the fire.
Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and this is your twice-weekly dose of Bathrob Spear's Broadsides, Civil Rights for the Poor, here in Santa Cruz and around the state. As I was mumbling before the theme song, We Didn't Start the Fire by Billy Joel, we have numerous reports coming in. Particularly interesting is a long interview with Marco of Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz, in which he talks about a number of upcoming and ongoing situations around tenants' rights with a lot of specifics, and that really is the heart of the situation for me, learning how tenants are being treated by landlords, even how small businesses who are tenants are being treated by landlords. So hopefully Marco should begin to talk about that subject sometime in the next half hour. We have lots of things happening. There was a benefit for the Beach Flats last night. There was a big brouhaha in the newspapers in the last couple of days about Karen Gillette's what a surprise. She's back again as head of the Homeless Community Resource Center. She has rescinded her resignation under condition that she be given absolute control. I should say her board be given veto power over board members of the other board, the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, that was going to merge with her board, that she doesn't like. Which, of course, means the end of any criticism of Karen Gillette and at the board level. So it wasn't enough that Gillette got an offer to take the executive directorship even without any kind of open interviews of other people. No, rather she had to determine that no one on the board could criticize her and live. Well, kind of typical of Karen, given the way she's run the homeless services, the free meal, and the Homeless Community Resource Center for the last 7 or 8 years. And incidentally, I'm not suggesting Karen Gillette shouldn't have been a director of this. I just find these tactics of resigning and pressuring and then drawing in Scott Kennedy, who, by the way, that's the reason Kennedy was not on my last show. He was scheduled to debate here with Keith Sugar on issues of the Beach Flats and other matters concerning the failure of not progressive politics, but politicians who use the label progressive, like Kennedy and Rotkin and Matthews. He wasn't at our show because he said he canceled for the third time because he had to go to the Homeless Community Resource Center, and essentially, I want to say he bullied the board into accepting all of Karen Gillette's demands. I wasn't at the board meeting. In fact, nobody was invited to the board meeting outside the board. That's one of the problems we've had with the Homeless Community Resource Center's board meetings. They've all been closed. So the homeless client wants to get in there. He has to go past Karen Gillette and get her personal approval before he or she can get into that meeting. That's how it's been for the last 2 or 3 years. That officially became that way when she pressured her board to make that a rule in the spring of 1997, when I, simply as a matter of form, because I'm not really interested in her board meetings, but felt they should be open on principle, tried to get into the board meeting, tried to find out even when they were, tried to get a copy of the agenda. None of that stuff was forthcoming. Her compliant board, which essentially is a bunch of merchants, Donna Murillo, Linda Steinau, it's a downtown business association stacked board, Don Lane, former mayor, or Gon Lame, as I call him, who heads the ice cream shop downtown, and who once was a kind of a hope for homeless people. He's also one of the yes people on her board. He was the so-called negotiator who was trying to negotiate with me, and I said, you know, I'd be happy to talk to you, but it seems the issue is really clear. Open up your board meetings. And Karen Gillette and Don Lane and their board's response was, we're closing the board meetings. Now, when they had negotiations with the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, one of the deals was they would have to open their board meetings. But if they can cut down and stack the boards, any such agreement could be eliminated once the new board meets. So it would be kind of a meaningless thing. Not that you're going to get too far even with open board meetings, but it seems kind of a primary Democratic necessity to have that, particularly if you're claiming to serve homeless people without any homeless members on your board. Karen Gillette hasn't had a homeless member on her board for years. I think she called in that old warhorse from Wisconsin, Brian Koepke, who suddenly showed up in town. He was the only homeless board member for the first couple years of the board. He was a homeless activist who was active with all of us in creating the services that Karen now reigns over. But he kind of became a part of her machine eventually and hasn't been around lately. I don't know what he said or what he's doing, and I don't want to trash him without having him on the show and give his point of view. So, Brian Koepke, if you're listening, please give a call. And anyone else, please give a call to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 423-5361. That's 423-5361 here in Santa Cruz. So I kind of strayed a bit there. Our main topic at the last show was the Beach Flats and the destruction of low-income housing there, the violation of process by the city council majority, intent on ramrodding through its own Seaside Company giveaway plan, which I guess there are only two more days till the environmental impact report, any input to that report closes down. You better, all you folks out there who have been following this issue, do get your letters in there. It's important, and perhaps I encourage anyone who has been following the Beach Flats to give me a call. The show is going to be kind of light on Beach Flats material today. We don't have any scheduled guests on Beach Flats. So if you want to call in and raise the issue on the phone, remind people of the addresses to write to for getting input into the environmental impact report, because while the city council can ignore you by law, apparently the environmental impact report folks have to respond to concerns about the Beach Flats with what you know, creating huge new parking lots, high roller coasters, destroying housing would do to the physical environment of the Beach Flats and how it would affect it and the kinds of concerns that people would have about that, which we've gone into at some length in the last couple of shows around that issue. We had Catherine Gunderson last time talking about it. Before that, we had Roxanne Akistapache. We've had Phil Baer on the air. We've had reports from Keith Sugar, who didn't actually do the debate last time as we'd hoped. His grandfather was in crisis in the hospital, and of course, Scott Kennedy suddenly slipped out the back door to go back, you know, beat the drums for the Homeless Community Resource Center. So that didn't happen. But we have had some excerpts and some very good ones about the Beach Flats issue, and I invite folks to call in on that issue. Also, lots of things are happening elsewhere around the, even around the Bay Area. For those of you who've been looking at the headlines of the Monterey Peninsula Herald, 4 days running, and maybe five, I haven't checked today's paper, the Monterey County Herald has had above-the-fold stories about this killing by police of an elderly man on a rooftop with a diagnosis of schizophrenic, who apparently challenged the police with, get this, no, it wasn't a toy gun, no, it wasn't a baseball bat this time, it was a corkscrew. And there's really a lot of anger from the relatives of this man, and I guess they've actually gotten the a psychiatric agency to investigate, an advocacy group for people with mentally diagnosed so-called mental illness conditions, to actually talk to the police officers to open an investigation of the matter, which I think might be one approach that some of us concerned with the Happy John Dine case hadn't thought of, that we might actually get somewhere with. Along the lines of the Happy John case, I have some information on that, and I'm still looking for the tape, which we made earlier, 2 or 3 days ago, in the office of Citizens Police Review Board staff person Gary Yamane. I haven't been too happy with Gary for the last month and a half. Those of you who have been following the show regularly know the Citizens Police Review Board, of course, that's the body handpicked by the City Council, which has refused to hold any independent investigations or public hearings into anything throughout the life of its existence, even when fatal shootings have happened. And their findings usually jibe with the police department. Their processes happen behind closed doors. They've driven all the most vigilant citizen members off the board, namely John Malkin and Gia Grant and others. So they're something between a bad joke and a sort of a sad joke. I don't know what it is. Anyway, they have... We went into their office after receiving word that the Happy John Dine radio dispatch tape that we had received was going to be open for comparison with the actual tape that the police review board heard. Because our tape, which has the specifics, it's a tape supposedly of radio dispatch around the John Dine shooting on November 13th. That's when Happy John was shot by Officer Connor Carey at the corner of Soquel and Front Street in the early evening for allegedly either reaching for, pointing, brandishing, maybe thinking of a toy gun. I'm making a joke about thinking of course. The original story from the police chief was he was pointing it. The story from the police review board was he was reaching for it. The story from the witnesses was he had nothing in his hand. He wasn't reaching for anything, as far as virtually every witness said. But, hey, the police officers were closest, and so, according to the police review board's January report, that's why they were believed, even though their stories were also wildly contradictory. Anyway, the police review tape on that, there was the police dispatch tape where you can hear radio transmissions between the officers concerned and headquarters. We were sent a copy of that tape, supposedly, but everything before the shooting was completely blank. We wrote a letter to the police chief saying, what's going on here? Santa Cruzans, for full disclosure, did, the organization investigating that situation. Police Chief Steve Belcher responded by saying, well, we don't know what you're talking about. We sent you the full uncensored tape, and we'll be happy to prove it by having it reviewed by Gary Yamane. And so we thought that, you know, he would be playing the full tape for us to compare. We went down there on Thursday morning, and he told us, oh, no, that's a secret tape. I can't play that. I haven't even got that tape. That's part of the personnel file of the police department. We can't play that, for heavens. No, no. So, but he did listen to our tape, and after listening for 15 seconds, he said, that's not the same tape I listened to. They've sent you a tape that has been erased or in some way changed. And he agreed that he would tell that to Police Chief Steve Belcher and request an official response. In other words, the tape being given out to the public was a censored tape or a doctored tape. You can actually hear the clicks where obviously some kind of erasing has happened, and you don't get to hear any conversations whatsoever between the two officers who are responsible for the death of Happy John Dine, specifically Officer Connor Carey, who shot him, and Officer Martin Over, who should have informed Officer Carey that Happy John Dine was no threat, but did not, or if he did, Officer Carey didn't answer, didn't respond to that, and we didn't know about it because the Police Review Board didn't investigate it. But this is all sort of old news. Very old news. On the other hand, since it hasn't been really publicized in broader quarters, perhaps it's news that we need to continue to consider, and hopefully we'll eventually get some kind of consideration. So we hope that there will be at least an official response from Police Chief Belcher about releasing the real tape, not the erased tape. That may be coming down the pike. And there's a very interesting story by John Malkin, who I mentioned earlier. He's a community activist around police matters. He was part of the Coalition for a Citizens Police Review Board, and then one of the first board members who finally resigned. And he explains why he resigned in this story in City on a Hill Press, which is in this week's City on a Hill Press. It came out on Thursday evening, and it's available different places around the east side. You can pick it up at, I think, the Bagelry and the laundromats. And on the west side or downtown, you can get it at Logos Bookstore. So I recommend you look at City on a Hill Press and John Malkin's long description of his
troubles with the police department and the Citizens Police Review Board, how they systematically tried to censor him, didn't support him, violated their own policies, and generally made a mockery of what was supposedly being created, an independent oversight body for the police department. Again, City on the Hill Press, John Malcolm. It's in the Writings on the Wall section. A lot of interesting stuff in the last four issues of the Monterey County Herald. We also have an upcoming city council meeting, as I mentioned when the show began, that's happening on Tuesday, as it usually does, the second and fourth Tuesday of every month. The evening session is at 7, the afternoon session is at 3:30. And usually what I do when these council meetings happen is I turn to David Silva. Those of you who are regular listeners already know, Silva is a man who really knows lots about city council. He knows lots about how to smell the scent of money getting flushed down the drain that I often don't notice. I mean, I kind of look for specific homeless issues and civil rights issues, but certainly other issues impact that, because if all the money is going to some out-of-town developer, there's nothing left for the police review board, or a real police review board if they ever made one. There's nothing left for real homeless services. I don't just mean this phony community house project that is really the cause of the current consternation around the Karen Gillette brouhaha, which I'm going to be talking about later in the show, and writing about as well. But City Council, of course, is supposed to be our first line of democratic process, where we actually can have some real input into what goes on in our city, how our money is spent, how
support the repeal of this inhumane law. We need to get it on the ballot. So those of you that have petitions have a real high integrity question that you're facing. If you're sitting on it, you need to get it out from under your butt and get it in, because it won't be changed by the city council without a lot of signatures coming in. Whether we qualify or not, the number of signatures will make a difference.
All right, so get those signatures in to what address, David?
144 Belmont Street. I'm accepting them right at my home.
144 Belmont at David Silva's home, and you can give him a call at
429-5284.
429-5284,
now,
please.
If you want to submit a check so we can help pay for...
check or gold bullion at the same address.
Gold bullion, so we can help pay for the homeless petition signature gatherers. And we have a professional person that was, just for 25 cents a signature, we had people out there, and we need to pay those people. Should I give our treasurer's phone number? Or?
Well, why don't the checks could be given directly to you, and then you could...
I don't do money. I do signatures.
Goes
to Becky.
I see. Okay, well, why don't if you have a check, you give a call to 423-8529. There we go. 423-8529 is the number to call for.
Or extension 182 of the...
No, too many numbers. That's fine.
Okay.
429-8529. Actually, anything about the sitting band petitions or signatures or money, or if you want to help some more with the issue, or if you want to know what's going on, give me a call at 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, and I will forward your call to the right place. That's an easy number to remember, 423-HUFF. Thank you, David Silva.
No problem. I hope all these questions I raised that it hit different people, and different people are interested in different issues, and they actually go and check out the supporting documents and ask the necessary questions, because that's what democracy is.
Thanks a lot, David.
Okay.
Well, that one lasted four times as long as I'd hoped. However, I, David, do appreciate this kind of detailed analysis, and I guess I'm hoping that in the future we'll have winnowed it more before putting it out over the air, so those of you who have less patience than I will have not tuned to KSCO in the meantime. But I do appreciate the help on this issue. There is no one in the community that knows these issues or is as sensitive to these that I know as David Silva. Well, we're still waiting for the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz to show up here in the studio because they did have a number of interesting issues that they brought out on the phone when I spoke to them yesterday. I talked to Warhorse Donna Dice, who has been fighting this fight at the cost of her own personal peace of mind. They've attempted to evict her twice in a retaliatory fashion with the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz. And more is the amazement. She and Marco have successfully gotten city council support from Scott Kennedy and Mike Rotkin, to their credit, individuals I often criticize and would prefer not to see on the council, actually. But in this case, they're making the right choices, and I want to commend them for that. So that's positive stuff. We hope they come in, or at least one of them comes in. What I've got for you now is a little something from the conference that happened way back when, actually beginning of the month, in Sacramento. Went off to Sacramento to a housing conference, which actually had some talk about civil rights for homeless people. And we spoke with one individual. I hope I have the right tape here that I'm looking at. I think what we'll do is we'll play the beginning of the tape and then I'll introduce it. That'll be the approach.
Talking to Alicia Ogden here at the California Housing, or is it Housing California 98?
And indeed, that is Alicia Ogden. Alicia is an activist from Salinas, and we did, of course, a couple of segments on the Salinas panhandling law 2 or 3 months ago. Salinas now has a ask for a dime, go to jail for up to 6 months law in some areas. And if you do it after dark, it's an immediate misdemeanor and crime. Santa Cruz, to its dubious credit, requires that you do it twice before it becomes a misdemeanor. Any request for food or money in Santa Cruz after dark is an automatic infraction, punishable by a $162 fine. And the second offense is up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine. That's not like the second offense, like nagging or haranguing or abusing. That's saying, excuse me, sir, could I have a dime for whatever? Could I have a dollar to buy a loaf of bread? Well, that's jail material, so you don't have to be Jean Valjean and Les Miserables to get jail for even just asking for spare change in Santa Cruz. So that is the Rotkin-Kennedy law. Same two gentlemen I spoke of earlier. Celia Scott wasn't on the council, and Catherine Byers, actually, I'm afraid it's time I have to say, Byers also voted for that law, which makes, I think, Byers... shows that she's not right all the time, that's for sure. Let's hear a little bit about Salinas now.
I guess it's the 4th of May. Hi, Alicia.
Hi.
And you're from Salinas?
Salinas, California.
And what's happening there with homeless folks? We know that your organization is not per se directly involved, but you are a connection with homeless rights groups there.
Yeah, there's an organization that's sort of an umbrella group for all the different homeless activist groups, and we do permanent housing and they do linking people up with current shelters and trying to get funding for more shelters and more homeless services.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember the name of that organization because it's a long acronym, but
it's around there somewhere.
It's in Marina. It's located in Marina, which is 15 miles from Salinas, and they cover the whole Monterey County.
Wow. You know, I often go through Marina when I travel south, but I never knew there was actually a group of homeless civil rights stalwarts who are ready to go out there and fight against such obscenities as the Salinas panhandling ban. Can you tell us something about that?
Actually, I don't know very much about the Salinas panhandling ban.
Indeed. Well, actually, it's one of these little laws that makes it a misdemeanor to ask for spare change after dark. Did you know that if you say, can I have a dime after dark downtown, that's up to 6 months in jail and $1,000 fine?
Well, if they want to pass that, then they should have more places for people to go after dark so they won't be on the streets asking for money then.
Well, it's actually kind of an enlightened law, which sets up the jail building business, gives the homeless places to stay behind secure, barred areas so they can't be attacked by bigots from the neighborhoods. And it also provides jobs for workers who are trying to, you know, increase the housing facilities, albeit somewhat stark, of Salinas.
Yeah, I've got to support those institutions, even if they're prison institutions, I guess.
Let's not be soft-hearted or soft-headed about this. The only good homeless person is a jailed homeless person. Anything you want to add, Alicia?
No, I just think there's a lot of good models out there. Maybe Salinas could be keeping their eyes open, looking for other models of homeless programs that are...
Tú hablas español también, ¿verdad?
Sí, hablo español.
And you've actually volunteered to do a little translating of this strange-looking alert San Diego stuff, this California Homeless Civil Rights Action Network literature. Have you worked with Spanish for a while?
I majored in Spanish, and I lived in Spain and Mexico and traveled through Guatemala, and we're a primarily Hispanic organization, so even though I'm not a native speaker, I work with native speakers that can help me out if I get stuck.
Now, you say farm workers are a large percentage of those affected by anti-homeless laws, let's say, in Salinas?
Definitely. We have people living in caves, cars, makeshift lean-tos on farmers' lands and just public land in general because there's no housing.
What kind of a town is Salinas in terms of how does it get its money? What is its primary business or industry? Is it, I guess, agricultural?
Agriculture is the biggest industry. It's a $2.2 billion industry, but they somehow can't afford to pay their workers a living wage, and so they end up living, like I said, in caves, or they have three or four families living in one house, or they're homeless, and there's not enough in the way of emergency shelters or transitional shelters. There's no longer the labor camps that they used to have because they made stricter laws so they would have better living conditions.
All for their own protection, of course.
Well, right. There are stricter laws so they have better labor camps, but instead of having that work and benefit for the farm workers, what it did is the farmers just shut down the labor camps altogether because they didn't want to pay to improve the living conditions. So now there's nothing for the single male migrant farm workers, let alone for the family farm workers.
John Steinbeck wrote about that in, what, Grapes of Wrath from the mid-30s, right?
Yeah, well, it hasn't gone away.
it's with us today. It's a form of preserving history, sort of a historical preservation activity. We're trying to protect our heritage, which is the poverty of the past.
Right. Rather than getting rid of the poverty, they're building a couple million dollar monument to John Steinbeck. It's currently under production. It'll bring in tourism, just what Salinas needs is more people.
You're referring to Steinbeck Plaza, correct? Something like that?
Yes. There's some monstrous new ugly building going in to John Steinbeck's honor. I don't think he'd be too honored by it, though.
This actually was admitted by, I think it was either council members or some business witnesses to the in the panhandling debate as to the reason why they wanted to have a law making it illegal for people to peacefully ask for spare change. We're not talking about a law which harasses you for pursuing or aggressively annoying, although those were partial provisions of the law, but the significant provisions had to do with the fact that just asking after a certain time of day becomes a crime. I assume unless, of course, you're a person in a business suit ringing the bell for Santa Claus or United Way, in which case I would wonder if they would cite you, but who knows? I mean, even Santa may not be welcome on some Salinas streets because there has to be, you know, organization. There has to be limits to the kinds of bummery that we're going to tolerate in Salinas. Wouldn't you agree?
Not really.
I see you're part of the problem rather than the solution. I will be reporting you to your local police. Anything you wish to add?
No, not really. I think we've covered it all. There's just a big need still for more money to go into all sorts of housing issues, from emergency shelters up to home ownership.
How large is Salinas? How many people live there?
About 120,000 people in a county of 350,000. And
Monterey County.
The West Coast part of it, the Monterey Peninsula, is totally tourism. Carmel, the median priced home is almost $500,000. And you can see how affordable that is.
How many shelter spaces are there for poor folks? I should also add, how many SROs have been destroyed in the last 30 years in terms of downtown hotels that you know of?
I don't know. I know that they're actually building a few SROs right now.
These are Mondo Condo, or is this for low-income folks?
Low-income. But I guess there's been problems with it in the way it's been done, and there's, I'm not sure what the problems are, but they haven't filled it up because of financial problems. I guess the SRO isn't quite low enough for the low income.
Uh-huh. What about shelters? How many people, let's say, are sleeping illegally in Salinas each night that you're aware of? How big is the homeless population in Salinas?
I think it's about 4,500. And in Monterey County, I believe that's from Monterey County. And the shelters are mostly run by churches. I don't think there's anything done by the government per se. There's no public housing, emergency shelters, as far as I know.
Are there laws against sleeping in your vehicle or sleeping outside in Salinas, as far as you know?
I don't know.
Well, of course, we'll be coming back to you to get a full report in about 24 hours to get the information. We want to thank you, Alicia, for your good work. Anything you... We have a comment from some hysterical woman over here. She wants to make some comment. Yes, what is it? We want to thank you again, Alicia, and anything you want to add?
No, that's all. It's my pleasure.
All right. Thank you, Alicia Dog.
And that was Alicia Ogden at the Housing 98 conference up in Sacramento at the beginning of the month, talking about Salinas and what's happening down in Salinas, sister city to the south. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz. Call in here is 423-5361 if you want to make any comments on anything you've heard or bring up subjects regarding civil rights for poor people or police misconduct or current events around the political process that you think we should be talking about. It's your radio station as well as ours. It's 423-5361 for a very simple way of putting your voice on the air so you're not just thinking gruffly in your own house, talking about or feeling frustrated on your own, but you're actually beginning to share your thoughts and feelings and opinions with other people in the community and getting some feedback on them and letting people know maybe you're not the only one who has gotten a sleeping ticket. Maybe you're not the only one who's been treated abusively by the police. Maybe you've been treated properly and you have a positive experience you want to relate. Whatever. Give a call to 423-5361. We're going to be on the air for the next hour here at Bathrop Spears Broadsides on 96.3 FM. If you want to contact Free Radio Santa Cruz off-air, and if you're interested in a show yourself or you want to donate money or you're interested in helping out the station is desperately looking for a place to stay where it can afford the rent. The voicemail number is 427-4523. Email is at Free Radio Santa Cruz, FRSC, actually, at cruzio.com. And the address by snail mail is Post Office Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. You can send us your PSAs, loop tapes, demo tapes, information you want broadcast on the air. Again, Post Office Box 7507, Santa Cruz, 95061. Or just leave a message on the voicemail, a minute or two in length, 427-4523. Well, lots of talking. Maybe it's time for a little singing. Getting a little tired of all these political topics, perhaps. Let's hear from some of those old-time religion folks, it being Sunday. At least they were kind of part of my religion when I was younger.
The ship's wise men will remind you once again.
That's Peter, Paul, and Mary. A song from the mid-60s by Bob Dylan, When the Ship Comes In. And when will that be? That's my question. Well, Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 is what you're tuned to, and our phone lines are open at 423-5361. Also picked up some interesting stuff from the papers and also from the Internet. Portland, Oregon, up north, has been kind of keeping an eye on not only what we've been doing around the Sleeping Ban Initiative, but also what its sister city to the south, Eugene, has been doing. Eugene actually, as those of you may know who've been listening to my show, passed a law making it legal for people to sleep in their vehicles in industrial areas. That has been the case since November, and actually it passed a subcommittee headed by the mayor for a two-year extension. And so it's apparently not just an idea whose time has come and a plan that's been implemented, but it's also a plan that has had some justification and in practice. And it's coming back and is going to be repeated for a longer period of time in Eugene. Why Santa Cruz can't follow Eugene isn't clear. Why we need a citizen initiative to make it legal for homeless people to sleep at night when we have less than 30 shelter spaces, that's floor spaces on the floor of the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program's summer church program, is not clear to me. But here's a couple stories from Portland. Here's one, Homeless People Work Toward Campaign Success, by Kaya Sand. On January 8th, Ramona Cowles lost her apartment. She set up camp in Forest Park with her husband, Jeremiah, carefully constructing a tent that did not disrupt the natural foliage. Each day, they carted out their garbage. On April 16th, the police tacked a sign on their tent that said, "Notice, illegal campground." On April 21st, the police stole their tent. Ramona and Jeremiah slept on the bare ground. On April 22nd, they slept in the rain. Ramona used a day's income selling the Burnside Cadillac, which is the homeless newspaper in Portland. Burnside Cadillac is like the street spirit in Santa Cruz or the street sheet in San Francisco. In front of Powell's, a location she shares with another vendor, George, to buy new plastic and poles, as well as launder their wet sleeping bags. She's saving her money to get an apartment and have shelter for her 14-year-old son, who is living with her adult daughter. And although she is determined to sell enough papers to rent a place, if I have to stand at Powell's day and night, she says, the sweep on her camp placed her in a much more difficult situation. She wasted 2 days dealing with the situation and a day's wages. And she is forced to fritter her energy on vigilance for further police action. The police occupy the precious time of homeless people with sweeps and tickets. People who might prefer devoting that time to coping with issues that keep them on the streets must spend it dealing with police-imposed problems. Ramona, a lifetime activist, would like to see Portland's anti-camping ordinance changed, and she's doing something about it. So far, she has gathered 300 signatures for the Campaign for Legal Places to Sleep, which seeks to present the names of 10,000 concerned Portlanders to City Council, demanding that the ordinance be repealed or amended. Volunteers have gathered about half the needed signatures. I think the general attitude about police cracking down on homeless people is that people are flabbergasted, said Ramona. There's no reason for it. Portland's anti-camping ordinance bars camping in public places. To camp means to set up, remain in, or at a campsite. A campsite is defined as any place where bedding, a sleeping bag, or other sleeping matter, or any stove or fire is placed, established, or maintained. Police generally include simply lying down, which is also illegal 24 hours a day, thanks to our downtown association and the folks on Karen Gillette's Homeless Community Resource Center board, Donna Murillo and Linda Steinow. They led that campaign in 1994 here in Santa Cruz. This ordinance criminalizes homelessness in Portland, where there are not enough beds and shelters, and where shelters often come with strings attached. The campaign outlines a maintenance plan, which includes a sliding scale and work plan applied to people who use the designated spaces. This includes utilities, waste disposal, upkeep, and security. The campaign also seeks to have homeless people included in the decision-making processes regarding the designated zones. There will be at least one place where the police can't hassle you and you can get some decent sleep, said Ramona. The repercussions of the anti-camping ordinance are part of Marcus and Gabriel's daily lives. I think those are her children. On a Sunday afternoon, no, sorry, these are two new people. On a Sunday afternoon across the street from Saturday Market, the two men rest inside a cement structure. Marcus is crouched on his haunches, standing occasionally. Gabriel is not that limber. He is stiffly semi-reclined on his duffel bag. "I'm disabled. It's kind of hard for me to get anywhere," said Gabriel. Several police bike by as we are talking. Marcus and Gabriel point out that without the buffer of a reporter, who appears not to be homeless, the police likely would have stopped and asked them to move on. "At the very least," said Marcus, "the police would have asked him to sit up. Lying down constitutes camping." "They shuffle you on," Marcus said of Portland police. "They say, you're no good. What do you think that? How do you think that makes a guy feel?" "In this town, it seems police have a real chip on their shoulder," added Marcus, who is from Connecticut, "more so than other places in the country. Here it's, I'm better than you. Why don't you go get a job?" Ramona, who studied sociology at the University of Oregon before the Reagan administration cut back financial aid, has some theories on police behavior. She draws from the sociologist Zimbardo as well as Maya Angelou. "Every human being has the same capacity when you are put in a position of power. You become the oppressor. When you are put in a position of the powerless, you become the victim or the rebel," Ramona said. She mulled this for a moment and then amended it. "Somewhere we make a decision. People who like having power over people go into these kinds of jobs. That is why you see a tendency for those people to become unreasonable. People who have a more balanced nature have a tendency to avoid these jobs." She also points out that for some police officers, faulty reasoning blurs the difference between homelessness and the so-called war on drugs, and sweeps and searches are an attempt to confiscate drugs. "The myth is, if you are homeless, you use drugs. You choose to be out there," said Ramona. "I think they are really going after drugs and alcohol. If you want to fight drugs and alcohol, don't harass people who are homeless. Don't make it impossible to survive." Recently, Ramona was ticketed for blocking the street and being a public nuisance. She was up against a building wall talking to a friend. The police blocked the 12-foot-wide sidewalk for 20 minutes with their large horses to ticket her. "When a cop is hassling someone just for personal entertainment, he's got lousy boundaries. He's breaking human laws," Ramona pointed out. Here's an aside from Santa Cruz. I'm reading this article from the Internet and the Portland campaign for legal places to sleep, part of the campaign for legal places to sleep going on up there now. Santa Cruz has the same kind of police situation where police gather in great numbers to engage in harassment. I mean, I've seen this as recently as 2 days ago, where on Friday afternoon, a man sitting on a bench at, I think it was Cedar and Pacific, talking to a fellow on a bicycle, and police, four or five police had gathered to check everybody's ID because of a dispute. It wasn't a fight, it was a dispute. And their IDs were being held and continued to be held, even though people were saying, "You have a right to take my ID," the police didn't answer. Police will actually do what you give them, you know, what you let them do often. They'll search you if you let them search you, they'll take your ID if you let them do that. They'll ask you questions without informing you of your right to an attorney often if you don't, you know, make it clear that you don't want to say anything. In this situation in Santa Cruz, when I came up and I had my tape recorder and I was recording all this, and I may be playing it later in the show, the police officers, one of whom was an officer with a German Shepherd dog who walks around the mall, that's Officer Brandt. I don't know what the name of his dog is, and I don't mean to badmouth the dog, although I certainly wouldn't want him to badmouth me, that's for sure. There was a kind of... Again, they were all set to continue this. They had there were two squad cars, a bicycle, again, four or five cops checking IDs for people who were essentially had to do with whether a bicycle hadn't moved down out of the red zone. And we're going to be hearing, by the way, some interviews of people on the mall soon here in Santa Cruz. They'll give you some actually direct testimony about how police are conducting themselves downtown. There's some police officers in there around the mall. And when I said to the officers involved and I said to the people involved, look, you don't have to give them your ID, and you don't have to identify yourselves at all unless you're accused of a crime. Unless there's reasonable suspicion for a detention, you can just tell them to go on your way, or perhaps, as one individual has suggested, take me to a magistrate if you have a problem. And when that was said, suddenly the ID started coming back from the police who were on the mall. And it's... The point is here that as long as the community tolerates
and incursions on basic civil rights, police will do it. And it's not because police are bad people. It's because they see that as the most effective way to do their job. I mean, they want to take pictures of every young person on the mall, and they want to put them on lists so that they can cross-index them with potential suspects here and there and so forth. Their job is to suspect anybody scruffy and grubby of criminal behavior. And perhaps people who aren't scruffy and grubby of, you know, criminal behavior, they're looking for to solve crimes. And they're also, unfortunately, looking to enforce a sort of, not just standards of behavior, I'd say standards of existence, on behalf of the merchant community and the conservative political community downtown. So, for example, obviously, non-criminal behavior, like sitting down near a store, within 10 feet of a store, has become criminal behavior, which means, of course, you can't sit anywhere on the mall virtually, with certain exceptions, and those exceptions will soon be gone because all the building is being done. And they've removed the benches from areas of the mall, so you have a few benches you can sit on. And actually, ironically, the guy that was, his ID was being taken was sitting on a bench. And the point was, of course, to intimidate people, to frighten them, and thought they might have some old warrants, to make them more tractable to police direction, even if the direction was unconstitutional or inappropriate or biased toward a particular, toward their merchant bosses. And I say that because it's the merchants who dictate the agenda downtown in terms of how people on the street are treated. That's been made clear with the city council surrender of the downtown ordinances in 1994 and since then as well. So, again, getting back to the situation in Portland, we're reading this from this article. So it was the police themselves that blocked the sidewalk and caused the problem and created the difficulty, according to this author. Police blocked the 12-foot-wide sidewalk for 20 minutes with their large horses to ticket her. When a cop is harassing someone just for personal entertainment, he's got lousy boundaries. He's breaking human laws, Ramona pointed out. People living outdoors in Portland are up against a catch-22. To not allow a police officer to search her, Ramona said, she has to fear retaliation. If one of my kids was in school, I would have told them not to let the police search them. When I had a house, I wouldn't have let the police in. My person is my place now. The last thing you have left is yourself. And after all the little trappings, the person is the last thing left. I don't care who you are, what your social position is, you exist. So you have a right to dignity and personal space, she continued. That needs to be recognized by everyone. Police sweeps carve apart the dignity and personal space. Ramona suggested that many people are skeptical that change is possible because the system has failed them time and time again. But she believes the campaign for legal places to sleep will make a difference. I've seen things get changed, said Ramona. I've been a part of getting things done. To find out more about the campaign for legal places to sleep, contact the Burnside Cadillac at 503-228-5657. Now, Burnside Cadillac is not a used car dealer. It's the name of a newspaper. And a Burnside Cadillac is, of course, a shopping cart. That's what they call it up in Portland, whose large street Burnside bifurcates the city up there in Oregon. And that's on the Internet. Came off about a, I don't know, 2 or 3 week-old story. Interesting stuff. Lots of interesting stuff in the media recently, too. Sometimes we follow the drug war. And you can hear from this last story why we follow the drug war. Because folks on the streets are most directly impacted by it. It also, of course, affects you folks in houses because they can come in, confiscate your, not just any herbs you have lying about or any medical marijuana that you're using, but you know, eventually confiscatory laws let them confiscate your property if you're engaging in any kind of druggish behavior. Or druggish behavior, that's really not the word. If you're using a substance that affects no one but you, but the police now have expansive powers. And, of course, they make all kinds of mistakes. And we've heard numerous instances of police actually killing the wrong people, breaking into the wrong house and so forth. And this whole story is so grim and sad and familiar that it doesn't need to be repeated here. But California has taken a different stance toward medical marijuana with the passage of Proposition 215. And I've been following here on the radio the recent counterattack by the federal government, which got Judge Breyer to uphold, essentially, not quite uphold an injunction, but to tell the clubs, six clubs in Northern California, that they couldn't proceed. And that's still being fought, but there's actually more bad news. The San Francisco Cannabis Club, run by Dennis Perone, kind of reorganized under a new ownership with a woman named Hazel Rogers. And they were attacked last week. And there's a story in the San Francisco Examiner I'm now going to read you about that. Pot club to fight closure ruling. Judge tells Healing Center to shut its doors in 5 days, by John Lynch and Eric Brazil. Sounding a familiar refrain in its fight to provide medical marijuana to the sick and dying, San Francisco's Cannabis Healing Center vowed to remain open and resist a judge's order to shut in 5 days, ruling that it is a public nuisance, not a primary caregiver, authorized to provide marijuana to people with AIDS and other illnesses. San Francisco Superior Court Judge William Cahill issued a temporary restraining order Thursday afternoon, that's 3 days ago, demanding the club's closure. The ruling came 3 days after a U.S. district judge ordered six Bay Area cannabis clubs to shut, saying federal drug laws supersede California's voter-approved Proposition 215. Cahill's ruling only applies to the San Francisco club. A lawyer for the cannabis club pledged to fight the ruling, saying that if the order is not reversed, patients and volunteers might resort to civil disobedience should authorities try to close them down. It could get very ugly, said attorney J. David Nick. Dennis Perone, founder of the center's predecessor, the Cannabis Cultivators Club, said he is braced for anything. Are they ready for another Waco, he asked, referring to the Texas obliteration of the Branch Davidian cult in an FBI assault. Are they stupid enough to do that? Yes. In his written ruling, Cahill said Hazel Rogers, 79-year-old director of the Pot Club, does not qualify as a primary caregiver of about 6,000 AIDS patients and others using the drugs for medicinal purposes under Proposition 215. Cahill ordered the sheriff to evict the center tenants at 1444 Market Street within 5 calendar days and to change the locks. It's another move on the chessboard, said Lynn Barnes, a registered nurse and volunteer spokeswoman for Californians for Compassionate Youth, also headquartered at the club. Our lawyers will be going back to court Friday, that's day before yesterday, to halt this action. We think we can get this action delayed. I attempted to contact Dennis Perone's office this morning and wasn't able to get through. Of course, it is Sunday, but the club, I think, is often open at different times. So we don't know if they were able to get it to stay on Sunday or what. But their number was not disconnected. It just rang, and it was about 9:30 in the morning, about an hour and a half, 2.5 hours ago. The San Francisco, we will be open tomorrow, she said Thursday. Nick said volunteers and patients may feel compelled to take very severe measures to resist orders from being carried out. 100 to 200 patients handcuffed inside the building, he said, people in wheelchairs, locking hands. I think the attorney general should think very hard if he wants that kind of thing. Cahill argued that Rogers' new outlet was not that different from the one operated by Perone at the site. Perone stepped down and turned the reins over to Rogers after the club closed April 20th, following another series of court battles. Cahill had denied State Attorney General Dan Lundgren's first request for a temporary restraining order against the center April 28th. At Thursday's hearing, Lundgren's deputies filed new affidavits in which drug agents said they bought marijuana from the center. Nick said drug agents should not be allowed to use phony documents to buy medical pot, but Cahill rejected his arguments. Oakland Cannabis Buyers Cooperative officials thwarted a similar effort Thursday. Executive Director Jeff Jones announced at a press conference that a DEA agent had tried to slip in to buy marijuana using a fake driver's license and doctor's recommendation. The long-haired man wearing camouflage pants and a T-shirt with a conspicuous pro-pot design in front presented identification as Brian Zanzi, but Jones said he believed this man to be Brian Nearing, refused to sell it to him and ordered him out. Pinned inside an elevator by a pack of reporters and TV camera operators, the man kept his head bowed and his hand over his face and refused to respond to questions. A DEA spokeswoman, Jocelyn Barnes, confirmed that an undercover agent went to the pot club on Thursday. DEA will continue to monitor all the pot clubs, and that will include a full range of techniques, including underground purchases, Barnes said. And this is an article in the Friday San Francisco Examiner, Pot Club to Fight Closure Ruling. And we're not quite sure what's going on up there, but that's the most recent story I've read, and I wanted to pass it on to you. Any thoughts on this? Give me a call, 423-5361. Have you suffered harassment because of your use of medical marijuana? Let's hear from you. Hi there, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Can barely hear you.
Okay, hang on. You're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Robert, how you doing?
Good. Are you listening to your radio caller?
No.
What you need to do probably is turn on your radio. Can you do that?
Well, I can hear you fine now.
Okay, well, the problem is that if we do it this way, we have transmission problems.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I should tell this to all callers. If you're calling, try to keep your radio on. Unlike other stations which have a delay, we don't have a delay. And it's more helpful for us if you keep your radio on.
Go ahead. It's on.
Okay, so...
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. So caller, what can we do for you?
Well, I wanted to get some comments from you about the Karen Gillette matter.
Oh, wow. Can you be more specific?
Sure. There's been a burst of publicity regarding Karen Gillette's resignation and then withdrawal of resignation and terms regarding the merged board that's to head Community House recently. Karen Gillette being what, the director of the, what's the name of her organization?
Homeless Community Resource Center?
Right, okay. Just to pull some stuff out of the Sentinel, 5/22/98, Gillette withdraws resignation. But Gillette determined that comments made privately about her mm-hmm. by a few Citizens Committee for the Homeless board members indicated that she would have a problem working for a merged board that might include some of those people. What do you make of that?
Well, actually, if you've been listening to the show, you've probably heard a few of my comments. Karen Gillette has been the, main person running the Homeless Community Resource Center, the head of it, in fact, and its predecessor, the Free Meal, since 1990. Actually, the Free Meal started in 1990 when Karen Gillette took over, actually kind of did a little coup behind the back of the previous Free Meal manager, who was a homeless activist named Jane Himmler, whose Hunger Fast established the River Street Mini Shelter and the actual property on which Karen Gillette's, it's actually not the same property. It's right next to the property Karen Gillette was on, but it's the property that her Free Meal was on before she moved it onto the property it's now on. Anyway, she has been sort of the city's fair-haired girl or woman running the program, and she's done some positive things for homeless people, no question about it, in terms of services. She was able, I think in conjunction with demonstrations by homeless activists that she... bad mouth at the same time. She was able to encourage the police department to open up the property where Community House is now situated about 5 or 6 years ago, so there was a place for people to sleep. She's been successful in maintaining the Free Meal, expanding services, as I guess David Silva mentioned earlier, to include lockers and phones and laundry and jobs, services. Certainly not enough, but certainly better than we had before. Again, in conjunction with activist activity, she sort of became the safety valve for the city, her program. And her program is a very positive one, and it should be commended for and supported. The problems that have developed in her program have to do with, some claim, cronyism. They have to do with the fact that she really has taken a severe hostility to some activists, like myself, and she literally spread rumors that jeopardized us physically. They claimed that we were trying to close down her meal and so forth. And originally she had a very bad grievance process. Linda Edwards, an early activist, was circulating a petition for better food. There have always been claims that Karen Gillette's staff takes the best cuts of the food and everybody else gets the lesser stuff. That's something I've heard actually repeated recently. But again, these are, there are, that could well be true, it could be false. But in terms of the specifics, the problem has often been with Karen, as I mentioned while David was on the air, David Silva, is that her process of management, really, she doesn't want any critics in any position of not just power, but even so they're visible and audible.
For example, on her board, she would not allow public to attend her board. And I fought this for several years because I thought, as a matter of principle, board meetings should be open. I didn't really find her board meetings that interesting when I read the agendas afterward or heard about what was going to be talked about. But I thought, as a matter of principle, they should be open to the public. And not just a matter of principle. I thought the Brown Act was also involved. Well, she claimed, no, we're not getting... We don't have a publicly appointed person on our board, therefore we don't have to open them to the public. Well, she's getting plenty of public funding, and my thought is, if you've got nothing to hide, why are you closing your board meetings? And, some people may write this off as some kind of personal, tiff between me and Karen. I thought it was a principled issue. And I also felt that it had to do with a bad policy of management, whereby Karen kind of made choices for her homeless clients without having much input from the clients, and no process for critics. Now, it is true, and she should be given credit for the fact that she has a better process for grievances than the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, which is the board that her Homeless Community Resource Center is going to merge with. They actually had a process, mainly because I objected and demanded there be such a process, for a woman who she or her staff threw out of the Homeless Community Resource Center, and she came and presented it to a subcommittee of her board at in a formal process, which is as it should be. I'm not going to comment on whether I feel there was a just result or not, but at least they allowed for that process. So there's a mixed bag with Karen. But in terms of the specific situation that you're mentioning, there has been a plan to merge the Citizens Committee for the Homeless, which is running this multi-million-dollar community house project, which I have long lambasted as a big boondoggle, as a big piece of a way of getting a lot of money for providing very few limited services. I mean, it's sort of another halfway house thing, which funds middle-class positions and pays for... It has the whole theory that it's not the housing problem, it's all these poor, mentally ill, drug, alcoholish type folks that need programs. I mean, certainly people need programs, but I felt for a long time that people also need emergency services that they're not getting and that are being constantly ignored here. And I'm thinking particularly of the right to sleep at night and a campground to camp in, obvious things the city has ignored. So what's showed up in the papers recently is apparently... there was going to be a new super board. There was going to be a merger of the Homeless Community Resource Center and the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. Not a complete merger, because they both want to keep money coming into both groups. It's required. You have independent groups, so you won't get as much money from the feds. But there would be kind of a combined board, and Karen would be the head of the new... She'd be the head of Community House. She'd be the head of the... her existing program, which is right next to Community House, which is the Homeless Community Resource Center, should be head of all this. And there were some people on the Citizens Committee for the Homeless board who had some criticisms of Karen. They were in the minority. They would not have prevailed. They made those criticisms at board meetings that were open to the public, because CCH board meetings have largely been open to the public, with some exceptions. And she didn't like what they said. And frankly, some of the things I heard, I didn't like either. I mean, there was talk about drug use, which I think is completely irrelevant. Karen smokes marijuana, so what? So do I, so does everybody else, and so should everybody have the right to do. And as long as it doesn't impact your performance, there should be no problem about that. And that's not right. So Karen, had a beef with some of the board members, but she also had a beef with some of the board members for other things, because Karen was challenged, for example, by Becky Johnson, who's a board member, not in her capacity on the board, but Karen backed this homeless community resource, this spare change, not real change, hoax, as I call it, this kind of merchant-funded throw paper at the homeless, let them eat paper downtown, which encouraged people not to give away money to homeless people, and instead give them a little yellow slip of paper that says, call this program, call that program, spend your money on the phones, and get there and find out there aren't any services anyway, because, as I've said repeatedly, there are less than 30 spaces for homeless people to sleep during most of the fall, summer, and spring in Santa Cruz. And there are more than 500 to 1,500 homeless people. Anyway, Becky Johnson wrote an editorial in the paper about a year or two ago saying that this program stunk, and
And Karen Gillette didn't like her position because Karen's pretty close to the merchants who are doing this program, and I think they had a private exchange of letters about it. But you know, it was, so what? It wasn't about the CCH. But Karen takes a lot of this stuff very personally, and she didn't like what Becky did. Apparently, Becky was a board member, and Becky also protested Karen's closed meetings. In fact, this was a more public issue. She and other board members made it a condition of merger that there be open meetings of the board, the new board, the merged board, that Karen Gillette would be the main head of. And I guess this was accepted. I don't know whether Karen specifically objected to this or not. But she announced she was, even after both boards announced they were going to appoint her and it was fine, she announced she was resigning. And the minute I heard this, frankly, I thought, this is not a real resignation. She's engaging in what we call a power play. She wants to terrorize homeless clients who like her and city council members who rely on her and merchants who, you know, also use her for controlling homeless people and also trust her, and frighten them into giving her more power. And indeed, she got more power. So when her resignation was rescinded on Friday, we learned that they're going to cut the board down to size, and they're going to give essentially her board veto power over the other board's composition. So in other words, Homeless Community Resource Center will be able to control will be able to veto people on the other board. It's also true the other board will be able to veto Homeless Community Resource Center people, but that's not relevant because there are no homeless people on the Homeless Community Resource Center board, really. There is one guy, Brian Koepke, who's come back to town. I wonder whether he was flown back to town by the merchants and Karen Gillette. I'm not sure. That's not fair. He may have hitchhiked back. But there hasn't been any homeless person on their board, whereas the Citizens Committee for the Homeless is incrementally better. They've actually had a formerly homeless woman on the board for some time who's been quite critical of Karen Gillette, outspokenly critical. And I think that kind of criticism is, you know, appropriate. I don't think it's necessarily, you don't have to believe it, but the fact that that criticism is allowed to exist is an important thing. Homeless people need to know they can criticize the people at the top without getting evicted from the services or shut down or threatened. And indeed, some of the criticisms about the Citizens Committee for the Homeless that I've heard has been that monitors of the ISSP program have threatened people in the program for simply pointing out abuses, like drug use by monitors, for instance, which, again, as I said, I think the whole drug issue is bullshit and is a complete diversion. But there are instances, if somebody is shooting up with heroin on site, visibly, in front of a family, that's completely inappropriate. And that apparently was a criticism made of an ISSP monitor by a family. And purportedly, the ISSP monitor then threatened that family, and the family actually left town. That's been a real concern. People have been really concerned about that. And I think it's appropriate to bring those kinds of things up. Those don't relate to Karen Gillette. They relate to the other program, the other board. And I've been critical, actually, of both boards at different times. But the business recently of purging the board, which Karen Gillette is trying to do, I think, is bad. It's not wise to remove all critics from the board. And it certainly shows, I think, an overweening and it seems like an overweening kind of power grab here. Karen is seeking powers she doesn't need, that she shouldn't have, and the city shouldn't give her. I mean, you know, she doesn't like some of the board members. Well, fine. She's got her own board under her thumb. The new board will essentially, they can't really do much without the say of her board. And it's, you know, there's no problem except that she wants, you know, one has to almost say it, absolute power here. And that, I think, is wrong. I mean, you saw this whole situation in miniature on Thursday night when Scott Kennedy didn't show up at this show, instead kind of went over to the Homeless Community Resource Center movement meeting, and they gave her complete power by acclamation. And again, they're using friendly people in the media like Karen Clark of the Sentinel and Kelly Luker of the Metro to push her agenda and to smear her critics. That's the problem. in a nutshell as far as I'm concerned. Any thoughts about that, caller? Are you still there or have you gone to sleep on it?
Hello?
Hi there.
I would bring up the possibility of tactical inappropriateness. And just to pull another couple of lines from the Sentinel, really, from May 22nd, Gillette never made public the comments from CCH board members that offended her. I think that's significant. And previously it stated here, Gillette determined that comments made privately about her by a few Citizens Committee for the Homeless board members indicated that she would have a problem working for the MERSH board. Okay, and then further on, it says Gillette never made public the comments, and also neither of these articles mentions any names, right? Keep those people off the MERSH board. This is from the Sentinel Saturday, May 23rd. The decision came after Gillette resigned, saying that she could not work with some members of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless Board. She rescinded that resignation Thursday night after her board made it clear they would try to keep those people off the MERSH board. What interests me is the ambiguousness of the charges, both what was allegedly said in private. Right, comments made privately about Karen Gillette, and I'm not calling into question Ms. Gillette's leadership with the Homeless Community Resource Center, and/or that she should be rightfully appointed head of the new organization that's going to be merged. But I think that this tactic is easily questionable as being inappropriate. And the principle that's at stake here, in my opinion, is the ambiguity of the charges and using the public press raise the issue without pointing out anything specific about the issue other than, you know, comments made privately. That's pretty intense in my reading, in my thinking.
Well, yeah, I think it's also interesting that I don't think any members of the Citizens Committee for the Homeless or the public were invited to her meeting on Thursday night where they had all these choices. In fact, I think when David Silva talked to her, she explicitly told him to stay away because he'd be perceived as an agent of Robert Norris, myself.
Well, again, I think that hopefully before this thing comes down, which it looks like is going to be Thursday at 4 o'clock at the Citizens Committee for the Homeless meeting, that publicly, after now there have been two articles alleging these private comments, that the private comments are made public and that the people that made the private comments are made public. And if we're going to start blocking things, by the way, as you indicated before, the Citizens Committee for the Homeless and these homeless resource centers do get government funds, so by some degree they have a responsibility to be above board. And I understand the ways around the Brown Act. Anticipated litigation is one way to get around the Brown Act, and of course personnel matters. Nonetheless, these kinds of open-ended slams about private comments and those people, right? I don't think it's the correct way to go about things in 1998.
Well, thank you, caller. Shall I? Let me give you the rest of the answer on the air. Or would you rather talk some more?
Go ahead. I'll listen to you off the air.
Okay. I appreciate that, caller, because I want to give other people a chance to call in at the same time on this issue. The problem here is the hypersensitivity of a person in a position of extreme power, Karen Gillette. Karen Gillette, as I've said repeatedly on this show, can do no wrong in the eyes of the city council. And it's got to be said, the Citizens Committee for the Homeless has made lots of mistakes. But so has Gillette. You know, she's made mistakes, too. We all should be entitled to make mistakes. What we should not be entitled to do is suppress other people. And as the caller has pointed out, Gillette doesn't like some of the things that certain board members have said privately in meetings, in private board meetings. Well, that's nice. I'm sure I don't like some of the things Karen Gillette has said. You know, I mean, all of us can't like what the rest of us say all the time. In fact, that's what makes democracy thrive. That's what we have as far as diversity goes. People have different opinions on things. The danger comes when one person has sufficient power to remove all her critics from positions of power. You know, I mean, that's really the point. And the problem is going to be that this may well be a done deal. I'm not sure, but it looks like a done deal to me coming down the pike. But for those of you who want to deal with this, I suggest three different meetings. I suggest showing up at the Social Services Committee meeting at City Council at 8:15 on Tuesday morning. That's day after tomorrow. And that'll be that's the first meeting. The second meeting is show up at 3:30 at the City Council meeting, where they're going to be talking about community house and this issue. Third thing is to show up at the Citizens Committee for the Homeless Board meeting, 2700 Soquel Avenue, St. Stephen's Lutheran Church, 4 to 6 p.m. on Thursday. We have a caller coming in. Hi, caller.
It's just me again. I just wanted to say that it is extremely important now that allegations have been laid out in the public. And Ms. Gillette is using the public forum to promote her position, that names become public and the allegations become public. That is extremely important. And that is, in my opinion, the crux of the matter.
Sure. I don't know if that's going to happen. I know that the problem is people on the board who are being criticized cannot really respond to Karen Gillette and still... retain the confidentiality and privacy of their board meetings. So that puts people, her critics, at a disadvantage. Gillette can say whatever she wants, and that's why it's very useful for her to resign. Because once she's resigned, of course, she can say whatever she wants.
Nonetheless, when the media mentions allegations and only refers to the people that allegedly made private comments as those people.
Right.
I mean, at some point, those people need to be identified, and these private comments need to be identified, or we are simply being willing to slough everything off to the degree that this appears to be.
Well, you know, it's interesting.
And once again, let me just say this.
Sure.
I don't think anything that I've said interferes with Ms. Gillette's track record as director of the Homeless Community Resource Center or anything else like that. The problem is the tactic here is extremely inappropriate. And for the media to go along with this tactic, some of those people, private comments, I think is horrendous.
Well, you know, Karen is no stranger to inappropriate tactics. I mean, I've mentioned before how in the past there was the infamous porta potty incident in 1991. Interestingly enough, involving both the Citizens Committee for the Homeless and Karen Gillette's what was then called the free meal. We had the Citizens Committee for the Homeless was closing down the tolerated campground area where Community House now sits early. And we had 27 people who said, you have no other legal place for us to be. You're the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. Let us stay. And we stayed there. And the Citizens Committee for the Homeless came in, filed trespass charges against us, and arrested three of us, myself and two homeless people, after everyone else left. Karen Gillette had been very uneasy with our protest. She'd been very critical of it. And somebody burned a porta potty. It wasn't anyone in my group that I know of who burned the porta potty while we were being arrested. I was actually in jail. And she became so furious, and irrationally so, I believe, she cut off all people that had anything to do with the protest from the free meal. She blamed us for that. She carted the porta potty directly to the place I was living, the apartment I was renting. And she dumped it in front of the house. She autographed it. It was covered with threats. She left a threatening message on my answering machine. And, you know, I mean, it was way overboard. You know,
well,
it was criminal behavior.
You should have filed a threats report.
I did.
I
had police officers out talking. You know, I showed them pictures and copies and documents. I brought the matter to City Council. Nothing was ever done.
Well, I want to come back to this, and
what I'm saying is that she's considered sacrosanct by the city establishment.
That may well be fine, but it should not play with the public, and it should not play on the front page, the upper front page of the newspaper record. I'm sorry. When the phraseology is some of those people and comments made privately, and when this goes on for 2 days,
Right, well,
comments made privately by some people.
This is a
right, and if this is used as a way to somehow or other justify this move that's being conducted actually as we speak right now, because I tend to agree that by Thursday the tactic is that let's hold up the charade and it'll be over with.
Well, my view of the whole situation
it's
is
important
is
that the names of the people be made public and the so-called private allegations that Ms. Gillette is using
do that,
the public
though.
Media
she won't
to,
do that,
to promote.
Call her up and tell her. I agree with you. I think it should be done.
I think it's a very, very important issue. In fact, I've never seen anything like this. Comments made privately. Some people.
Right, right. Well, you're quoting from a newspaper story, I guess.
That's right. Therefore, if that this is so dramatically one-sided and imbalanced that it doesn't even resemble freedom of speech and dialogue.
Well, as I said,
I mean, what are we preparing for the next century?
Well, I think the real question is
this the kind of tactic that
right.
Santa Cruz is going to tolerate?
Well, I think the real question is what the impact is going to be on the homeless services that's happening here. I mean, I think that the presence of critics on the board are an important functioning part of a positive presentation of services. And I think when Karen Gillette, through using the newspapers and her board, makes it a condition to eliminate all critics through these sort of veiled charges, that they do a disservice to the homeless community. And I also think when she does this grandstanding by resigning at and misrepresenting to other people that, I mean, she was already appointed. She had the job, but somehow that she's being treated badly, and therefore now her only response could be to eliminate all her critics. It's overkill. It's wrong. And I agree. I think the newspapers are being used. I've got some guests who come into the studio, though, that I'd like to continue talking to.
Just five more words.
Okay.
Comments made privately and those people. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. And, yeah, I have to agree with the caller that we're going to see further injustice in the week ahead. We're going to see this board purge because Karen Gillette just doesn't like the board. You know, with a flounce of her hair, she can eliminate people she doesn't like from the board. And that really is a pity, because you give that kind of power to someone, you put the rest of the people she serves in a bad, bad situation, I really think. Hey, that's my view. I'm Bathrobe Spear Robert Norris. You can give me a call and give me your view at 423-5361 here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. And then the folks I've been bad-mouthing and complaining about have actually showed up in the studio. That's TRUSC, Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz. They are here, and they are ready, I hope, to talk. Donna Dice, get over here.
It's not very nice of you, Robert, to criticize us while we're out gathering petition signatures for the homeless initiative.
Yes, I was bad-mouthing Donna, and I'm about to get, I hope, slapped several times across the face here. I would like to publicly apologize. I was expecting you around noon, and I thought that possibly you had forgotten the engagement, but I'm glad to see that you're here.
Well, your other half called us this morning and asked us to talk to the Methodist Church.
Right.
And we got two petition signs.
Excellent. Thank you for showing my apologies for my premature eruption. So.
And how many more signatures do we need now?
That matter I'm not sure of. I think that David Silva, the keeper of the signatures, is the one who lets us know that. Marco, are you prepared to give me a savage tongue lashing, or what do you think?
What happened?
Oh, well.
What
I've been.
I'm always ready.
I've been a bad boy. Come on up to the mic here. We need to get everybody has to get. You've
been
the,
a mal niño.
I've been a bad. Yes, exactly. A mal niño. Mm. Well, Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz is really a unique organization. I don't know of any other organization in a city that has actually spends the time, based on the very few resources you have, you go down to the court, you check for unlawful detainers, and you send out postcards. Are you copycatting some of the organization? Or are you the first to do this?
No. In fact, Legal Aid had a meeting with us a couple of weeks ago, and they're very supportive of what we're doing. Uh-huh. The board recommended they have a subcommittee to work with us, and they're happy what we're doing because they feel restricted by the Brown Act, where they're not supposed to solicit people to come to the organization. Since we do outreach and send people to legal aid first, if they qualify and can get help from them, that's providing a service for them as well.
Well, what you do, as I understand it, is you actually check the court records for places where the landlord has filed suit to get people out of the premises, and then you inform people of their rights. Is that accurate?
Right, and we have our home phone, which is also our business office, so that we can answer calls on the weekend and in the evenings where it's more convenient for people.
The first of many repetitions of this phone number, what is that phone number then?
426-0644.
And what I was saying was, I mean, this requires a lot of legwork. You go down to the court, you write down all these cases, you go home, you write up postcards, you go out to the post box, you file all the postcards, you send them out in the mail. Do you know of any other agency that does this in any other city? I mean, is this a new thing you've begun, or is this something that's actually been done before?
It hasn't been done before, to my knowledge, and Marco originated the concept because most people don't realize we have access to some public records.
Okay. Let me move this mic a little closer. Marco.
Hi.
Hi, Marco.
Hello out there. Don't forget to call us here.
Let's give that phone number again.
426-0644.
And again, that's the phone number for the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz. You can call them anytime. If you want to talk to these two individuals in person, give a call to 423-5361. We've talked about a number of things before the show, Donna, and I really was impressed with the heavy and full kind of a docket and agenda that you have, and the many things have been happening. Boy, we haven't got much time left in the show. Landlord violence against tenants has been one issue that's come up that I haven't heard much talked about. What's that all about?
Well, a lot of women, either single or with children, tend to be put in a vulnerable position with a landlord who may be an alcoholic or want to have some kind of, shall we say, sexual relationship with the tenant, and they use this successfully against the tenant because of the laws and the judges.
Has this happened recently with any particular landlords or people?
Yes, just this week there was a couple of calls, which we do have regularly, calls of this nature. One lady, her boyfriend and her had been friends since they were 6 years old. He beat her up so badly he's in jail for 3 months, and he gives her 3-day notice. And a lawyer is willing to support him to evict her.
So he sent her a notice from jail to evict her after beating her up.
Yes, and I'm sorry, I meant to say an attorney is willing to take this case.
Is this because she isn't paying her rent, or is he's just punishing her?
He's just punishing her. They don't have any oral or written contract.
Any comments on this, Marco?
There was another incident where a landlord beat up on a tenant during the process of an eviction. That was many cases. Yeah, there's one last month I was thinking of. Yes, that's landlords really take advantage in many ways, and women are usually the victims.
And mothers, because they're into a nurturing relationship with their children, and they have to deal with these evil landlords and unscrupulous attorneys, which is not within their sphere of daily life.
Then there's the, of course, the classic and traditional gun-toting landlords of Boulder Creek in the mountains.
And the summit, too.
That's violence.
And anything more about these NRA members?
Oh, not recently. No, well, within a month or two, yes.
The summit case.
Yeah, there's the summit case.
What about, should we talk about the summit case?
Oh, no, not really. It's just another example. I think we have a lot of things to talk about, a little time to talk.
Okay, well, not just the landlords, not just residents had problems with their landlords, but tenants include small businesses, correct?
Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
I understand it. Can you talk about that, for a particular case of a small business that's being harassed by a landlord? You were telling me about it on the phone, but is that public information now?
Yes, there's a Chinese restaurant. They're immigrants, and they only have one person that can translate between Chinese. Luckily, they got our postcard, and we were able to communicate with them through a translator that works with them to urge them to take action, because they only had 5 days to respond. And some people just don't always take these things as seriously as they need to, and then they're out on the street.
Can we tell what restaurant that is?
Not, I don't think it would be proper at this point.
Okay. You also are looking for, you actually gotten some funding from the city council, and of course the question about your...
Never actually did.
Oh, really?
No,
haven't gotten that funding.
I got a cent from any organization. Or...
Is that happening? Or?
The $1,200 was allocated to us as a grant, only in paper, if we were to apply for, and if we still do, apply for a special use permit from the city. We still have that $1,200 there available for us.
Is there some reason not to apply for a special use permit?
Well, it depends on when we rent something, if we have to get a special use permit. But right now, the 261 Water Street is kaput for us. The sheriff had dibs on it from the beginning. We knew that going into it. And we just didn't think he was going to pull up his card at this point.
So the sheriff has evicted you from your claim to the... A little
more
potential
like
office
preemptive eviction.
Prejudgment claim to right of possession.
all you legal types out there. But you are looking for another grant from, I guess, from a Vanguard organization?
Yes. The Tenants Congress seems to be in good standing with the Vanguard organization, and they might just fund the Tenants Congress and indirectly the Tenants Rights Union.
I know the Vanguard organization gave a grant to Paul Bowden of the Coalition on Homelessness this year. It's for a sabbatical. He's a guy who's been fighting for rights of homeless people up in San Francisco with Street Sheet and the Coalition on Homelessness fighting the Matrix raids. You've also been having sort of some unusual cases of tenants being harassed, for example, because they want access to the riverfront area, something about vandalism, a fence and a gate. Is that discussable on the air? Or?
Well, at the Riverview Apartments, where Donna lives, they put up a fence, and there was always access to the levee. And they put up a wrought iron fence, and there was a cyclone fence that was always being cut, so there was always access, like an easement, as they say, to the levee. They put up a wrought iron fence, and I requested to the property management 3 or 4 times as the fence was going up and before it was finished to put in a swing gate with a master key on both sides and that could be given to tenants so tenants only could have access to that gate and that resolves the security problem. And they never did, and the gate went up and there were people at the apartment complex who were radical and militant about having their easement, and they tried to open up the wrought iron fence with some other alternate device.
I say sort of.
They were evicted for that. And that's property management's fault because the owner now loses a month of rent, and these people are evicted because property management was too stupid or willing to put up that two-way fence.
Now, is there a two-way fence there yet?
No.
Is there a hole in the fence which has been engineered by, shall we say, a creative monkey wrenching?
A small one, but it wasn't completed.
Okay. For all you folks who want to go down and complete that hole in the fence, no, just kidding. Let me ask you this: what kind of recourse do folks have? Can they go to court on this issue, or are they going to fight this as a retaliatory eviction in some way, or what? Or is it a done deal?
They're gone. From what I understand, they just
we didn't get a chance to talk to them.
We're talking, let me see if I understand the situation. This is the levee, of course, has become an issue of high profile, actually not as high as I would like, but it's been criminalized after dark up and down the levee. You can't be on there at night. What kind of access were the folks in your apartment seeking?
Well, it wouldn't have cost, we asked the workmen if it would cost any more to put a gate in while they were putting the fence up. They said it wouldn't cost any more. So I don't know if we had contacted the owner directly, if we could have gotten a better response.
Why do you want access to the levee? I mean, you want to go down there and shoot up crack with all those dirty drug heads? What's going on?
We don't want to have to walk all the way around the block just to get on the river. That's our way to go downtown, and most of the people use that access.
So you're not a criminal gang of drug users?
No, and then the apartments on the other side, it's subsidized housing, and they routinely evict people for stupid things like throwing mud at the fence or, you know, children playing in the
riding the bicycles
yard
in the parking lot.
They also are trying to evict someone over there for vandalizing.
That same property management has violated our civil rights, and we're taking them to the ACLU, trying to get the ACLU to make it a project of theirs so that we can go on their property and organize, put up our cards, put up our posters, knock on doors. They're accused, threatening us with prosecution if we go there right now at this moment.
Indeed, I've heard similarly with the folks trying to circulate the petition to repeal the sleeping ban in an apartment not far from the studio, actually. There was a similar problem. Thereabouts, yeah. Although I certainly wouldn't want to reveal the secret location of the studio to the FCC, who already knows. In any case, yeah. So what are the chances that the ACLU, which is renowned for doing nothing locally for year after year on basic homeless rights issues, helping your right to organize at that apartment?
Okay. Right now, Diane took it to her legal committee meeting, which they had last week, and I haven't heard back from her yet. I imagine I'll get back to her after the holiday.
Well, that sounds like potential good news. I understand that the sleeping ban initiative is also being considered by the same ACLU's legal committee.
Right, and Ed Fry is, I talked to Ed Fry about it, and he said, sounds like a good test case, and I talked to another lawyer, Paul Sanford, and he says he'd be willing to jump in on the fray next, when he comes back in the middle of June.
You can send these attorneys our way when you're finished.
Oh, yeah. We'll be working together on this.
Now another concern I heard from you, Donna, I guess it was yesterday, was that the local judges seem to be ignoring the law around habitability when the questions have come up. So, for instance, if a person's being evicted and they claim, hey, this is not a habitable apartment, the judges, even judges like judges that are supposed to be liberal, are turning into Republican landlord agents.
I don't think any of the judges are supposed to be liberal. I think they're supposed to be conservative and uphold the status quo. And they're very threatened by any organization that tries to come in and say, hey, you're entitled to read the law books and file papers and fight back. That's a very radical concept for a lot of people.
How has this manifested itself, their hostility or their apprehension by the judges?
Well, we've had some really good cases prepared that we think definitely should have won, and they've gone down the tubes. I don't believe it's through any fault of our own, but simply because the judges are making local rulings considering what they think habitability should be in Santa Cruz.
Are you talking about judges like the Right Honorable Sam Stevens and possibly our famous judge McAdams, and these are judges that are well known for their liberal reputations.
Well, according to inside source at Legal Aid, they're all registered Republicans.
Well, that's your frightening realities here. Arbor Cove housing, is that something we can talk about here or not?
It's a senior complex. And evidently the people there are very afraid of being evicted because they're older and they're disabled and there's no other place for them to move to. And people are taking off their shoes to walk up the steps because they're afraid they're going to wake somebody up and somebody's going to complain and they're going to be the next one to go sleep in their car at 60-some years old.
So that has happened? A number of seniors have been evicted and are now sleeping in their vehicles?
No, there's one lady I know. She had been there since the beginning. She'd been through a rough divorce, and she asserted her rights. She was the president of the complex, and here it's supposed to be a cooperative. Well, the new manager that came in was not cooperative. She wanted to dominate, and she effectively got rid of Gwen. Now Gwen has to pay a lot more rent.
What kind of recourse do folks in that complex have? Can they organize against this?
Yeah, if they get the guts together to do so.
And you had some things you wanted to say, Marco. I'm sure I've forgotten a number of issues, although we're on the edge of the end of the program.
Well, we're in a campaign in the drive right now to go before the Board of Supervisors, the City Council, and Capitola. We put in requests for $70,000 in grant money from them, and we really could use an office, which this grant money would provide us, a lawyer on retainer, and a full-time activist working with us, and that's what we're asking for. So any activists out there, proactivists who want to help us with this next two-week push to to lobby different organizations, get letters of support, phone calls of support to the Board of Supervisors. We need Jan Buttes as a swing vote for us. We have the City Council, and in Capitola, we need this one swing vote also. So if you please get in touch with us at 426-0644 and help us in the next 2 or 3 weeks do this budget thing so we can possibly get $70,000 for the Tenants' Rights Union.
That's 426-0644. You're talking to Marco and Donna of the Tenants' Rights Union Santa Cruz Trust. You can also, of course, let them know if you're having problems with your own landlord, if you're a landlord who wants to break ranks and help out, if you want to help them with their own daily work, 426-0644. Donna, any closing comments yourself? We got a clipping.
That's in the Sunday Chronicle today, and article about Jesse Jackson and a talk with Professor Jane Malden, who gave some stark statistics on poverty in her speech, and I'm quoting, "While the poorest one-fifth of Americans make $4 more per month than they did in 1980, the top one-fifth make $2,300 more, and the top 5% make $6,200 more. The poverty remains persistent despite startling economic growth. To challenge us all," she said.
Definitely. And I had hoped to read about Proposition, what is it, E, the new landlord sellout thing happening in San Francisco, which I haven't had time to do. Is there anything you want to say about that as I cue up our goodbye music?
Well, all power to the San Francisco Tenants Union and defeating that.
Dig it. And I second that. As I see,
it's de-control of rent for apartments under 12 units, which is approximately 50,000 units.
So 50,000 units or people in 2,000 units are going to be bounced out on their ear if this Proposition E passes, if landlords want to raise the rents and the folks can't afford them.
Yes.
In a word. I want to thank you both for coming in today and apologize for my hasty apprehension and paranoia. I will recommend a suitable punishment off-air.
I want that T-shirt, the old Stop SWAT and the Police State T-shirt.
Oh, that old T-shirt. I'll have to find that one for you. You were around in the 70s.
I made that T-shirt.
You made that T-shirt?
Yes, I was in the group that made that T-shirt.
Take note.
I made the T-shirt, too.
Take note, SWAT teams. He's here. He's got to be stopped.
The first originator of the, not myself, but part of the movement for the first Police Review Commission in Santa Cruz. Back in 1978, we had it on the ballot.
Community Against Legalized Militarism.
I'm an old commie from way back, C-A-L-M.
So there you are. Confessions here on the air. Well, listen, thank you for being with us today. I'm going to whip into our theme song music and invite you to come back to Baffert Spears Broadsides on Thursday at 6. For those who are interested in the Scott Kennedy debate, Kennedy has approached me and offered to come on the air again. Frankly, I'm not too eager to have him cancel for a fourth time and keep people running around, but we'll see if something could be worked out. Who knows? It's a possibility. Do come to City Council meeting tomorrow, I should say Tuesday, following the Citizens Committee for the Homeless brouhaha, the community house stuff. That's happening at 8:15 in the morning at the mayor's office on Tuesday morning. You can also come to City Council at 3:30 and in the evening at 7 on the same day, Tuesday. And the Citizens Committee for the Homeless board meeting is on Thursday at 2700 Soquel Avenue, St. Stephen's Lutheran Church, 4 to 6, open to the public. If you've gotten any of these times, give me a call, 423-HUFF. I will answer it for you. Thanks, and thank you. Hey, it's Reckless and Tom Reveille. Wow, what a show must be coming down the pike. Stay with us. Watergate, punk rock.
Robert Norris. What a great show. Just took that out real quick. This is Reckless. Special guest today, Tom Revelry. Old time revolutionary kind of thing going on. We're going to talk about some stuff. First, before I start my show, I'd like to... we have a problem here at Freak Radio. We have no idea what our listenership is. We have no idea how many people are listening to us at any given time. I'd like to invite everyone that is tuned in, that has access to a phone, to go ahead and call in. I'd like to get at least 20 callers. We're not going to put you on the air. You don't have to say anything. We just want to get an idea of how many people are out there tuned in at any given time. So I'm going to open us up with a song. Give you a chance to dial in 423-5361. We have an interview with Asada Shakur coming up, some poetry, some Crash Worship, Dead Can Dance, some other kind of music, and talk. So please give us a call if you're tuned in at all and you have access to a phone, 423-5361.
Seven to the war machine.
Dan coming up next on the stream of free radio on the net, actually, and also, of course, on the archives here for HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. It is the 19th of October, 2023, Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, which is yet another flashback, which is a little hard to kind of pinpoint in time. It's from May of 1998, and I've been kind of struggling with this one throughout the afternoon to get a clear sense of exactly which show it is. But the people who put this in the archives, and I was probably one of them, didn't do a very clear job. But in any case, this is it covers a variety of topics. It's a studio show, so you'll be invited to call in. Of course, there's no studio to call into. If you have any comments on what you've heard from this 30-year-old show, nearly 30 years old, call me on the HUF line. That's at Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, 831-423-4833. And eventually I'll probably get back to you with if I have ideas of what might be helpful for answering your question. So, this was around the time when we were struggling to unsuccessfully get enough signatures for the second battle to put the sleeping ban law, the municipal code 6.36, on the ballot so it could be repealed. We got a lot of signatures, but this was, I think, the year of El Nino, the severe weather storms and such. That's really not a good excuse for why we failed. We had a number of people going out trying it. We didn't have paid signature gatherers. And I guess there isn't a lot of talk about that. I think David Silva, an activist who was with us until about 5 years ago when he died overseas, he was one of the main organizers of this effort. You'll hear some familiar voices here if you're a longtime listener. Battling Bob LaMonica comes in, trying to understand what was going on with the change of management with the Homeless Community Resource Center, which